evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guests are Nancy Lazarus and Joan Adler. Both are longtime members of the Moosewood Restaurant Collective. Adler has been a member since 1975. She's the co-author of five of the Moosewood Collective cookbooks, and she also teaches vegetarian cooking classes and does TV cooking demonstrations. Lazarus has been a member since 1978. She's the co-author of 11 of the Moosewood Collective cookbooks, and she's currently president of the board of directors. Welcome to the show to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Now, you know what? I want to begin by talking about how this idea for a vegetarian restaurant first came about way back in 1973.
You want to?
I can start.
Okay,
I can start,
Jen.
Because I actually have been at the restaurant since 1974, so it was a year after the restaurant was founded. And even though I wasn't there right at the onset, there were this group of seven friends who wanted to do something that was creative and collectivized, communal, cooperative, had a great love of food, had a lot of energy right out of college, and one of the members was fortunate enough to have a trust fund, a small trust fund, and was able to lay down what we think is a laughably small amount of money right now. I think it was like $10,000 or $15,000,
something like that.
Uh-huh. We're able to buy the material for the restaurant, the barn boards, and together they built this restaurant and one of the important things was that they would be providing delicious food that was healthful and whole grain. We were very influenced at the time by Diet for a Small Planet.
Oh, yes.
By Frances Morvan LePay, and equally influenced by the vegetarian Epicure, which sort of appealed because it was Epicurean. You know, it was very delicious, and it also taught us skills that, you know, cooking skills beyond the basics as well. This was a group that, you know, was excited about this venture, but also wanted to have fun and was very influenced by the 60s movement to flatten the hierarchies of business and design a new business structure and a new way of working together.
Yeah, I definitely want to talk about that. So in 1977, the restaurant really became well known around the country with the publication of the Moosewood Cookbook, which was by Molly Katzen, but it was a collective effort that produced that book, right?
The recipes in that book were developed in the Moosewood kitchen, and Molly is the author. Mm-hmm. She was with Moosewood for the first 3 years that the restaurant was open, and then she wanted to go back to Berkeley, so she headed back to the West Coast and has not been connected with Moosewood since then. Mm-hmm. But that cookbook is just so popular. It hit a nerve at that time in the country, and so did Moosewood Restaurant, I think. Being vegetarian was at that time pretty unusual, and it was very
good
difficult.
Vegetarian.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
You know, vegetarian had a reputation even then as this bland, horrible, tasteless,
you know, and indigestible.
Yeah, people, and so we've always tried to do really good tasting food, and I think we have. Mm-hmm. Of the 19 people who are Moosewood Collective members now, I think none of us, maybe one of us has a little bit of culinary training, but we've all pretty much learned on the job at Moosewood.
See, that's what I was going to ask you. So you guys all had a vision and you wanted to start this restaurant. Did you actually have to fly by the seat of your pants? Did anybody have business experience, experience, cooking experience for large numbers?
No.
That's
the simple answer. And actually, I think Molly had been the only person who'd actually worked in a restaurant prior. What we were interested in from the start was that the international possibilities of vegetarian cookery. Mm. And also, that's also a sort of a principal area where the cooking of Frances Morvan LePay it was Frances Morvan LePay, but more of Anna Thomas with the Vegetarian Epicure comes into play here, because her book really did sample the great variety of vegetarian dishes that that were alive in different countries. And we always had a very adventurous spirit and a great openness to all kinds of cookery. And so we were bringing that very early on to our menus. We were, you know, foods from India, foods from South America, foods from...
Americans,
you know,
were
Southeast
not attuned
Asia.
To foods from other countries back in the... I mean,
too much Chinese,
many did,
Chinese,
sort of.
Yeah.
We called
yeah.
it
Italian.
And back
and some
before
Italian.
Fusion was used to describe almost everything. I used to call our cooking fusion cooking because uh-huh. we very freely took elements of different cultural ingredients and ways, techniques for cooking and stuff, and mixed and matched. Because often, you know, particularly when you're developing vegetarian food and you're eliminating the meat, you need for it to be very interesting.
Mm-hmm. And different kinds of spices.
And we were discovering all kinds of new spices and herbs and flavors and ingredients. And so we started seeing all of the potential for using these various ingredients in different ways. And certainly we had, you know, or
been
our mothers
up with,
had
probably, yes.
during our
yeah.
childhood.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
been a
I mean,
really...
American cooking was pretty bland in the 40s
yeah.
and 50s.
Yeah.
And
but we did come with our sentimental attachments, and we did come with wanting to recreate comfort foods and mm-hmm. foods that we'd known, and we'd
yeah.
come from we'd come from pretty different backgrounds, you know, if not socioeconomically, ethnically, and we've often looked to recreate foods that resonate.
Without the meat in them, right?
Right, without yeah. the meat in it.
Yeah. Now, 1973, when the restaurant opened, the 60s was very much still alive then. Mm-hmm. What were people bringing political agendas to the table who wanted to join the collective? How was that dealt with? Or was it just everybody wanted to make good food and be...
Well, you know, was it in 1976 when the collective bought the restaurant from the original owners?
Mm.
And it had been operating... collectively, and we use that term collective pretty loosely ourselves. There is a legal definition. We're not legally a
yeah,
collective,
yeah.
but we mean working together and, you know, supporting each other and filling in for each other when need be, and that kind of collective work. And we've made decisions collectively. Mm-hmm. That's evolved a
so,
lot
so you think
over
that's part
the years.
That's part of the 60s politics. That
it
oh,
is,
right.
although I don't know that it was such a conscious political decision. I think at least... by the time I came along, which is 30 years ago, what I felt was happening was people wanted to have a place to work that offered them creativity and security and support, and it was pleasant. I had been teaching before I came to Moosewood and worked for the summer, and it was just such a joy to be with people who were articulate and were reading novels and seeing movies and working together so well, you know, I got sucked in, and that's pretty much what happened with all of us, I think.
Well, I would diverge a little bit from that, having come...
Uh-oh, what's Joan going to tell us?
Yes,
no, we'll find out.
Well, coming in 1974, and at that point, we were very conscious that we wanted something that was fluid. We were very conscious that we didn't want to typecast any of the restaurant, any of the players and any of the roles. For the most part, you know, the cooks were also waiting on tables mm. and bussing dishes and doing the payroll and cleaning the grease trap. And we took uh-huh. pride in that. You know,
oh,
we
I'll
thought
bet.
That this was a way that it made sense because we were learning all of the roles and we had empathy for every job. And there was even a period of time where there was some political intention in even flattening the relationship between the waiter and the person being waited on, our guest.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, I remember when we were at our most nervy, you know, or our most whatever, you know, we would be taking orders and we'd be actually sitting down at the table with the person
oh,
and looking
yes.
at them face to face. So I do feel it was a time that was definitely grown out of the 60s.
Uh-huh.
And I know that, you know, we were dressing in outfits that were not, you know, outfits that would distinguish us from the people
Certainly
we were
not
serving.
Black pants and white shirts.
They
yeah,
weren't they weren't uniforms. You know, probably our parents would have been just outraged that we were running a business.
Like a culinary rock
completely.
Band.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
This is absolutely true what Jonah's saying. But I guess what I meant is I don't think there was any name or title or formulated political philosophy that we were trying to somehow embody. Mm-hmm. We were doing what made us really comfortable and happy, and this was part of it.
Yeah. And as a result, since we really did want to sort of celebrate the facets of everyone who worked there outside of the restaurant as well as inside of the restaurant, there wasn't a requirement that you work any number of shifts, you know, per week. So our numbers were ballooning to like 26 and
really?
30 people working there because people were, you know, having to do their art and having to do their music and having to do their crafts and, you know, and would come in for a shift or two. But as we matured, you know, as in the next few years, you know, we saw that it was really a very inefficient way to rent a restaurant. And not only that, we were suffering from inconsistency, a lack of consistency. And we did make the decision that we were going to collapse our numbers, collapse the collective to a more workable number. And there was this commitment that we ultimately made a decision that we were going to extract from the people that wanted to continue at the restaurant that each person would work four shifts a week, so 4 days a week.
So you did have to come up with some kind of structure.
We did, yes.
Because I did want to talk to you about the concept of the collective. You mm-hmm. know, a lot of people don't believe anything but a hierarchy can really work because that means there's no leaders, right? Mm-hmm. So tell us how it worked. Obviously, what?
Well,
Majority ruled?
We actually tried for consensus through most of our history. But consensus doesn't mean a unanimous attitude or opinion about something. It doesn't mean always agreeing. It means coming to what you think is the best solution given all of the elements that you're dealing with mm-hmm. at the time. And we did flatten the hierarchy, but that doesn't mean that we didn't have leaders. You know, leaders, mm-hmm. they weren't always the same people leading in every area, and one person may be a leader in one area for a while and then shift to another area, which mm-hmm. was also that flexibility to do a whole bunch of different things and to really do new things, to be learning constantly was a big part of what kept people working at Moosewood, I think.
I would second that. Mm-hmm. I think the wonderful thing about Moosewood was that the opportunity to learn so many things. I mean, we were learning how to cook. We were learning how to run a restaurant. We were learning how to
write cookbooks, too.
We were learning how to write. We were learning how to research. We were learning how to create business plans and business structures. And as Laura Bronco, who's one of our partners, had written a little something on the collective, and she said that leadership is irrepressible. And I think that's absolutely true.
That's an interesting concept. Yeah, it usually does.
And it's not something to be fearful of.
Mm-hmm.
If you recognize it across the board.
Yeah. How did you deal? I've asked other people this. How did you deal in a huge group if there was somebody who was an egomaniac and who did want to take over? Did you have any kind of
intervention?
Yeah, or way to deal with something like that. I can't imagine huge groups of people. There wouldn't be one or two.
There have been times when that's happened, and my memory of it is that the first thing we would do is talk about it and talk to the person about it and talk about, you know, how their behavior was affecting other people. And also, though, I think we recognized that, you know, some people are more vocal or excitable or, you know, mm-hmm. whatever than other people. And so there have been periods when at our meetings, at which 20 people are attending with an equal voice, and it's not that they didn't have structure either. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have had structure. But that we consciously tried to get people who were more retiring or less likely to want to, you know, commit to an opinion to be saying what they were thinking. You know, we've done various things that are done in a lot of groups where when a big issue has arisen, before decisions are made, we would go around and every single person has the opportunity in a structured way to say what they think about that. Mm-hmm. So that has always helped. And I think that it's also helped that those among us who are more assertive or whatever have really tried to stand back and give airtime to other people. And, you know, it's been a cooperative effort all along.
I think it's
in
the only way
level.
To keep a family together.
Yeah, it's very like that.
You have to let everybody have a voice.
Yeah, I would agree. And, you know, Nancy laughingly talked about intervention, and we have brought people from the outside. when mm-hmm. things have, you know, have gotten to standstills, or, you know, we've been having some interpersonal problems. We've called in outside mediators and arbiters.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Joan Adler and Nancy Lazarus. They are very, very early founding members of the Moosewood Collective. Now, I want to get a little bit personal. Joan, tell us, what were you doing that made you want to join this collective at that point in your life when you were a young woman?
Well, this is fairly easy. I was, at that time, had recently graduated from Cornell University and had fallen in love with Ithaca. Felt like I wanted it. Ithaca felt like home to me. I grew up in Newark, New Jersey, and I can't imagine a city that's as different from Newark as Ithaca is. Had begun right after college to, wasn't clear what I wanted to, what next steps to take, you know, what I wanted to do. Began working at the public library, and Moosewood opened in 1973, and I began eating lunch at Moosewood. And thought that the food was absolutely delicious. I mean, it was my first introduction to mulligatawny. It was my first introduction to these tastes that I hadn't, you know, that I had never encountered. And the truth is, I've always loved food. I loved eating. It's always been a big deal in our household. But it wasn't very adventurous, but my palate was wide open and welcoming. And I was really aware that this also was a business that was being run in this cooperative way. And I had just come straight out of a co-op in college, which I had, you know, thoroughly enjoyed. So I was drawn to both the structure of the organization and the food and this possibility of learning a skill, because I really didn't know how to cook before I came to Moosewood. I was just a great lover and appreciator.
Wow, that's amazing. What about you, Nancy? What was your road?
I graduated from the University of Maryland in 1973 and was married to my husband, Rick, at the time. And we decided that instead of finding a job, you know, following a career wherever it led us around the country, we would find the place that we wanted to live.
Interesting.
Which, you know, is probably also an idea out of the 60s. I'm not sure. I see young people doing that again now,
though.
Well,
the place can be inside your head.
Right. So we went to Nova Scotia for a while, but we had to come back and do our taxes. And we came to Ithaca because my sister Susan was here. She's also a Moosewood person and has been since very early on.
She was the first Moosewood. She was the first person who was not an owner
worked
at Moosewood.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. She was in that first year of 1973.
I learned something. Anyway, so we came to visit Susan, you know, for the summer and sort of plan what we were going to do. And Ithaca just grabbed us. There are these hills. I grew up in Central Florida and then lived in Maryland for a while in high school and college. And the hills, the lake, I mean, it's a little far from the coast for me, but,
I agree.
Still just so beautiful. And we arrived in the spring when the daffodils were coming up. It was a beautiful spring. Mm. And the following winter, there was a lot of snow, which was extremely exciting to me and still is.
Is it?
I still love snow. And
So did you also have lunch at the Moosewood and decide you wanted to?
Well, I did. I don't remember my very first introduction to Moosewood. I do remember eating food that my sister was preparing that was influenced by Moosewood because she was cooking there then and friends of hers. And I remember going to some recipe tasting parties early on with various Moosewood cooks. Preparing dishes for people to respond to and say, you know, what they like, what they didn't like about it. I started teaching in Spencer. And then I said before what happened, I came to work for the summer, and I did go back to teaching still part-time for a couple of years, but eventually became full-time Moosewood because
wow.
I just
what a great adventure
got so involved.
I wanted to bring up the fact that in 2000, Bon Appetit magazine called the Moosewood one of the most influential restaurants of the 20th century. Were you guys amazed to talk to us about
it? Oh, it was wonderful.
We were totally amazed. We were, and so, what is the word? Well, we were, of course, very proud, but sometimes you just don't get a sense of how far-reaching an impact your life and accomplishments have had. So it was awesome.
Well, were they talking about the influence of vegetarianism, or what did they mean by that? Do you know?
Well, I have. Can I
go
just
ahead.
Jump in here?
Go ahead, Jen.
Okay, because I've been thinking about this. I do feel like it was yes, of course, it was the influence of vegetarianism, but I also feel it was the influence of vegetarianism that a person could translate for themselves in a way that was delicious and edible and doable. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like our cookbooks are very welcoming, very instructive, very, you can do this. Here are the simple steps that you need. Here are the few spices that you need in your closet. Don't be afraid of whole grains. We'll tell you how to, you know, we'll show you how to prepare them. We'll, you know, don't be afraid of dried beans, that sort of thing. I mean, I feel like we actually probably taught a lot of people, you know, how to cook the way we cook. Mm-hmm. And then there's this other piece too, and I don't know whether this has anything to do with that, you know, glorious appreciation, that 2000 Bon Appetit piece, but I feel like a lot of people in the late 60s and early 70s, it was a heady time. I honestly feel like they felt like they were doing something very, very different in their lives at that time. They were making different choices. They were questioning everything. They were living communitively and cooperatively. And we are a symbol of those times for people. And you know how young people are. I mean, they're just so uncompromising and so full of zeal and so intolerant of compromise and hypocrisy. And it's this pure time, you know, kind of philosophically in people's lives. And we translated that into a restaurant, you know, in this ideal way. And of course, I honestly feel like we were kind of totemic, you know, or symbolic of this time in people's lives that was really special to them.
Did you have anything to add?
Bon Appetit said it was for popularizing. I'm not sure
bring
that was there.
Bring us back to Earth.
To vegetarianism. And, of course, that's happened thoroughly in the last 30 years.
Oh,
Howard Johnson's was one of the other restaurants, and that was for providing a consistent menu that people, you know, I mean, so they were really all over the map in who they appreciated and why. And it's a very interesting article to read for that reason. And we did feel very proud.
Oh, I'll bet you did.
Yeah.
You are really coming out with an incredible product, and you've changed people's ways of eating, I think. You know, all over the country. So tell me how the collective has changed, though, through the years. I know you have a system where people do all kinds of jobs within the restaurant and learn all the skills that you need to learn. Do you still do that with the collective? Or if somebody comes and says, I'm a chef, do you make them go through the process and learn how to be a dishwasher and do all that stuff still?
No, everybody doesn't do everything anymore in the restaurant, although most people are capable of doing almost everything. There are now some people who only cook. Some of this has happened because we've aged physically. You know, so some of us find that we're more comfortable doing some jobs than other jobs. I mean, people who are in the collective. And that's translated. But I think the way it's changed most has been that we are much more ready to delegate authority than we used to be. I mean, we really literally had collective meetings every Sunday morning, every third week, or more often when needed, for years, because we really were, everybody had a say about every single thing, almost. I mean,
including,
you know, there was some...
You know, who would use what garbage disposal system we would use.
Really?
Yeah.
We would decide these big publishing decisions
within the
and
organization.
And also, what color are the, you know, new blinds going to be? And sometimes what color the new blinds going to be would take more time and effort and energy and
some of the larger questions.
So what's happened is we really have learned. Also, we've diversified. I mean, in that we're not just running a restaurant anymore. We also write the cookbooks. We also have food products. There are various ones of us who do consulting and cooking classes. So that has required that some people become really good at certain things. And we've realized that when somebody gets to be really proficient and good at something, they should do it, you know?
That makes sense.
And we all benefit from that.
Yeah.
So I think it has, to me, that's one of the most basic changes that we have really tried to recognize people's, we always tried to recognize people's skills and talents, but...
Now you just direct them
Let them
to
go,
it now,
you know, huh? say, you know, you go and you do this and let us know what's going on. But you don't have to check back with us at every little step of the way.
I would like to say that the challenge to that has been letting go.
Mm-hmm. I'll bet.
Because mm-hmm. we were so involved in everything that it was really a rather unfamiliar sensation to have a group of us make certain decisions and not, I mean, we certainly could have input if we wanted to, but that would mean going to a number of different meetings, you know, with the different committees that were overseeing mm-hmm. different mm-hmm. facets of the restaurant. And, that was a challenge. And I actually would like to say, just for our listeners out there, that, you know, we have stabilized the collective. The collective has been stabilized at 18 of us, and we have a very, very large employed staff that are not members of the collective at this point.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask you that when you mentioned that you've all gotten older and so on. Are you thinking about the future? Are you going
to
take on some new members as you guys all just end up in the vegetarian restaurant?
We have a meeting Sunday that's a lot about that. Yes, we are figuring out that we really do need to make plans for the continuation, you know, when mm-hmm. when we're not still involved.
Have you got second generations joining the collective from your original group? Has that happened in that way?
It hasn't happened that way. Not joining the collective, because we did limit it at 18 and people... Mm. Our youngest.
We have very little turnover.
I don't know. The 8 years, 9 years is.
That's quite amazing. That really says something about how you guys deal.
So we're on a precipice. I mean, we're on the edge of a new, something new coming, and we don't know quite what it is yet mm-hmm. about how we structure the business and our decision making and everything else.
You know, we only have about a minute left. I know you've started a food line that's mm-hmm. being sold in retail. Grocery stores and stuff. Well, what else for the future, real quickly? Any more new ideas coming out of the Moosewood or new products?
Well, we think about that all the time. And one of the problems for us personally is we all want to be in Ithaca. We're not big travelers. This makes us not entrepreneurs in the sense of, you know, going out and starting a new restaurant in Madison, mm-hmm. Wisconsin or something. But that is part of what we're thinking about in terms of our future. You know, maybe it's time that we partner with other people, or I'm not sure. Yeah, there's mm-hmm. so many different ways we could approach it. And so we're at the stage of really looking at what the possibilities are and deciding which direction we want to head off in.
Well, we look forward to whatever you guys do, and I know the integrity of the restaurant here in Ithaca is just going to stay the same.
There's no question about that.
I thank you both for joining us, and I really wish you well in the future. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been great.
It's been wonderful.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by Finger Lakes Arts Grants and Services. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.